My name is Michael Hatfield, but most people here call me Miguel, and I teach the Appropriate Technologies class here, which is one of the three subjects of research we focus on, and I also work in our practical work is often in third world running stove projects, running projects to build fuel-efficient stoves, so I do that also.
Yeah, my name is Peter Scott, and I've been at Aprovecho for 5 years. And I've been doing appropriate technology work for that time. And I mostly focus on international work, so I'm a stove consultant. I do projects in Central America and in Africa.
Yeah. Okay, Peter. And
my name is Dean Still. I came here 12 years ago and had no idea that I would find my life's work here at APRO, but I'm glad I did. And I've done lots of different things around here, helped to bring up the campus and to work in appropriate technology. But what I do right now is I'm the coordinator for advanced studies in appropriate technology and doing research into stoves mostly.
Why don't you tell us about Aprovecho and, you know, how it came about and what you folks do.
Does it necessarily need to be one person? Can we all kind of like...
Yeah, no, please do. Everybody jump in.
Well, when I came here in 89, Aprovecho mostly was about 10 people who were working farming and trying to have a demonstration center for sustainable living. And they had bought this place because they were doing consultancies overseas. Six people in 1976 in Guatemala had helped to develop a fuel-efficient wood stove, and this stove had become famous. People had gone all over the world building the stove. And so the consultants, who were very countercultural, decided that they were being paid $100 a day, $200 a day, and they felt not comfortable with that. They decided that they would pay themselves $250 a month and put the rest in the bank. So after 4 or 5 years of going all around the world and working for most of the big agencies in the world, USAID and GTZ, ITGG, and all the Peace Corps, I imagine them being hot and sweaty and longing for the green hills of Oregon. So they came back here, they bought this 40-acre site, and decided to try to live like the people that they'd been helping, to really figure out how do we make tools that help people, but not just the tools, how do we farm, how do we protect the forest. And with a very hardcore countercultural bent, not wearing shoes, no hot water, living outdoors, no insulation in the houses, that sort of thing.
So we've gone through a lot of change and development in time and have learned a lot, and kind of now our present form is would be...
We're now wearing shoes.
We're now wearing shoes. We've learned that insulation is a nice thing to have in houses, yeah. For sure. And we've kind of, right now, presently, the form Aprovecho is in, it's the 40-acre land still, and we focus on three subjects, and one of those is sustainable forestry. So we have about 35 acres of forest, about half of that, about 22 acres, actually, of that, we sustainably thin, manage. Our forester, Matthew Hall, decides when it should be cut and where, in the hopes of making it what he calls a managed old growth. So actually he's pulling out less wood than grows each year, so we use for our building needs and for our energy needs. But we cut the trees down, bring them out with horses, mill it on site, and then we use it for our buildings, and the wood never leaves the property. So, and we teach that to the students. And that's one subject. Then we also do organic agriculture, or more organic gardening. We have about an acre and a half of a garden that we work in and to supply most of our fresh food needs. And then we also do appropriate technology subjects.
I noticed in reading on your website that you work in conjunction with University of Oregon on some of your projects.
Various universities. University of Oregon is one of them. Yes. Uh-huh.
just recently, we've been starting to look at emissions problems in stoves and material problems in stoves. How can someone make a material out of ceramic that is insulative and refractory, not to break down with heat? And then also, how can you make a stove that doesn't kill people when they're breathing the smoke? Universities have a lot of equipment that's sitting around, and students are looking for things to do. So we're now associated with 5 universities, Iowa State, Washington, Dayton, etc. And Colorado State has a really good engines lab that helps us out. So we help the universities to be to know what's going on in the real world, hopefully, and for them to be addressing problems that actually help folks. So that's called ETHOS, Engineers and Technical Humanitarian Opportunities of Service. And that's one of the things that I try to coordinate.
Okay. One of the things that we haven't touched on yet is the internship program. So most of Aprovecho's focus and energy is directed towards an internship program. So 10 to 14 students, 3 times a year, for 10 weeks, come and learn all these things. So they have intensive study in organic gardening, ecoforestry, and appropriate technology.
So it adds up to like 40 students?
About 40 to anywhere from like 35 to 45 students for the whole year. Uh-huh. As well as we also have students come for what Dean was talking about, was the advanced studies in appropriate technology. So students also come for shorter periods of time. And so it would be interesting for your listeners, if people are interested in learning about helping people in the third world, living lightly on the land, living sustainably, living in a community, they can come and experience that and actually get college credit for. Lots of students get college. And
what do these students do when they leave an internship?
Well, their minds are kind of scrambled when they first leave because they have to go back into the real world.
Yeah.
But some of the students have gone on to do some international work, to do some appropriate technology work overseas. But a lot of people have stayed around here in the community and have become farmers and organic gardeners. A lot of people have gone on to do like social justice and environmental type projects, environmental type work. So,
And a lot of the stuff you're learning about here is just how to incorporate, is growing some of your own food. So no matter where you're going back to, you can incorporate how to supply a little more of your energy needs. You know, solar showers or cooking with the sun, or if you want to cook a little more with wood. So people where their lifestyles. A lot of people coming out of college, or they're living somewhere. And then they go right back to that, and then they can just incorporate some of that stuff into their daily lives. It doesn't necessarily need to be a whole change in occupation.
So my daughter has solar panels that heats their water.
Yeah, we teach students how to build their own panels of that sort, and set up a simple system for heating their water.
I think another part of it is that colleges and universities tend to teach people by having them read about stuff. That would be okay if what you read was true. But a lot of what you read isn't true, even in the sciences. So I think that our philosophical or educational approach is different than that, where if you want to learn how do you heat water, you can just put a bowl of water outside, darken the inside, and see how hot does the water get. Then you have an immediate experience that you can rely on. And when someone asks you, hey, how much will the sun heat a bowl of water, you can tell them exactly, and they can believe you. So I think that that's something that is different here. It's hands-on. It's if you want to know something, it's very simple to make experiments that will teach you about it. And in fact, after you've done a series of experiments, you probably have easily gone somewhere where not many people have gone, and you're learning something that is of value, not only to yourself, but to other people. I think that's the amazing thing about appropriate technology, where you have to make the stuff yourself, be able to fix it yourself, that your experiments only cost $5, and you can keep on going and going, learning more and more. In the end of 6 months, you can be one of the world's experts on a subject that is of great use to folks all over the world. And it's by that kind of learning that is aimed at a noble purpose, which is to help us live sustainably, that you can find a great worth in education. It's not just baloney. It's not just stuff you read in books. It's what's going to help us save the world, but it's going to be practical stuff. It's not going to be how many angels dance on the head of a pin for some stupid professor.
Yeah, I use that expression quite often. What do you guys think about technology, now that you've raised that subject? Main Street, typical America, and their focus on technology.
Right. Well, I guess we'd all have our own personal answer for that. But I think that in many ways we're anti-large-scale technology, so it's like we're opposed to, like, nuclear power plants, for example. But, technology is anything as simple as, like, a spoon or a fork or a very simple wood stove. And so if you look at it in the world right now, there's 3 billion people who cook with wood, with biomass.
Right.
And they're cooking over open fire, Stone Age technology. So, like, small amounts of appropriate or intermediate technology can really make a difference for those people's lives. So it's not like we're anti-technology. In fact, we're writing a grant to get some state-of-the-art technology so we can do better stove testing. So it's just all about appropriate use.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'd say, like, I think myself, I personally came as a Luddite here, as a lot of us did, but just eventually came to realize, for one, that we obviously need some technologies. There's 6 billion people on the planet, so this large-scale technology is going to be out there, but it's not really what we focus on. Like, in my class, I talk a little bit about hydrogen, and maybe some as far as large-scale things we want to go towards versus nuclear that maybe is the future, but what we kind of focus on is what we actually can do. And, I mean, I'm not going to build, a large-scale energy plant. But what I am going to do in my life and what I can empower people to do is how to supply some of their hot water needs by building a simple solar shower, how to solve someone's cooking needs by making a fuel-efficient wood stove. So it's more, I'd say, just the important thing is not even to ask what our personal philosophical questions are, but just where we choose to focus our time, which is in that way.
But it does give you a certain independence that most of us don't have, in the fact that, if, for example, there was a gigantic depression and everybody was out of work, you guys would be able to sustain yourself better than the average person.
We wouldn't really notice. It would take us, if there was a giant depression, it would take us a year before we found out, maybe.
Yeah. But, knowing that, has real merit in terms of, just the way that you face the world,
Sure. Yeah. And that's some of our students come here and don't even know how to chop wood. Do you know what I mean? So it's like, if the fan, they would really be, they're out of luck.
Yeah.
And so there's, like, skills like that they can learn. Plus, they can also learn, like, high-end stove testing or about, like, actual or how organic gardening works. So there's a full scale of things that students learn. Yeah.
But I would say, like, a one word that kind of sums up what we do here is empowerment, personal empowerment. Maybe two words there.
And, they're long and good words.
But as far as just, like, trying to supply some of those needs that you can supply yourself.
Yeah.
They are doable. A lot of people, like I said, somebody comes and doesn't know how to chop wood. It's like that. So it's basic.
There's three cartoons by R. Crumb. One is everything ending in disaster. Everything's burnt and the people are scrubbing for worms in the dust. The next one is the hippie wonderful dream of everyone having their own little farm and people are in tie-dye wandering around having a very simple life. And the third one is the more Jetsons thing where somehow technology, cold fusion, has saved us from the ecological disaster and we're all buzzing around having fun. I don't think that we know. It's hard to predict the future. We hope that we're not aiming towards Armageddon. But I do think that in either of those scenarios, appropriate technology is what's making them possible. And that good appropriate technology is as considered as evolved in the farming context as it is in the Jetson context. It's just that you've made it look different. You've made it respond to, but it has to respond to human needs in both if it's going to be sustainable.
What is a rocket stove? And why do they call it a rocket stove?
Okay, well, a rocket stove was invented, I guess, in 1982, 1983 by a guy named Dr. Larry Winiarski. And so there were people at that point who were building high-mass stoves all around the world. And Dr. Larry...
Heavy stoves made out of sand and clay.
Right. Right. And people had never done any real testing on finding out how fuel efficient they were, never really applied, you know, real principles of combustion or heat transfer to the stove. And so Larry developed a stove called a rocket stove, which was an insulated stove, which metered the fuel, which had very high heat, so very little smoke. So this stove was pretty radical. Even today, there's very few people building insulated stoves that don't produce a lot of smoke. So since 1982, people have gone all around the world building rocket-type stoves. So in Central America, we've built maybe 3,000, maybe 4,000 rocket-type stoves. So these are stoves for cooking tortillas and pots, and they have chimneys. And then we also have projects where people are building much simpler rocket stoves. No chimney, but very little smoke because of the design and shape of the stove.
And what they're replacing is open fires within people's homes.
For the most part, yeah. I mean, some people might have, almost all the people we work with are cooking with an open fire, or certainly don't have a chimney in their house, but some people cook open fires outside the house or inside the house. Right. Some people might have like a simple ceramic or a simple clay box that they cook yeah. in. Very rudimentary.
Or they may be replacing an actual, like we may be coming into a project that is now building these large, heavy stoves that have been now, you know, in the relief world, been now built for the last 30 years or so, and people are still building them for various reasons, even though they turn to be less efficient than what an open fire would be. But they do get the smoke out of the house. That's one reason people tend to go in there. So we're also replacing, in a sense, these higher mass stoves, which are even less efficient and using more wood.
And when I saw your website, you've calculated the efficiency of open fire of a rocket stove, or at least there's a link to that kind of research,
mm-hmm.
and you know the efficiency. And then you've looked into more efficient rocket stoves. And what does a rocket stove cost if I wanted to build one?
It could be as little as free going to the dump. One of the classes we do with students here is building them out of used tin cans,
right.
soup and coffee cans, and they're great little backpacking stoves. Like I take them with me backpacking all the time, and for cooking one small pot, they're perfect. But so that could be the cheapest is free, and then depending on how good of materials, you know, it goes up.
One of the projects is trying to figure out how to teach brickmakers in Central America how to make lightweight refractory bricks. And so those bricks should cost maybe 30 cents each. Six of them would make a stove. And we hope that those bricks would last for a very long time and make a very good stove.
So it's for a simple single pot rocket stove, the simplest, $5 or $10 maybe in materials if you want to even get like nice materials.
Yeah. So we were just talking about the prices of stoves. So the simplest stoves are free, but then there are also more complicated stoves that might go for $65 or $70 in Central America. People spend a lot of money on fuel wood in Central America. Some people who sell tortillas might spend $1,200 a year. $200 on wood. So even if a stove is $60 or $70, they can still recoup the savings.
Yeah, pretty quickly.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So it, you know, that's one way of for a very small amount of money to be able to make real impact, real change, actually add years to people's lives in third world country.
And there's a 3 to 8 times higher chance of advanced respiratory illness when you have an open fire in the house.
The UN just put out a report which cost $200 million, and one wonders if that was money that could have been a little bit more wisely spent, saying that in India alone, 500,000 people a year are dying because of pollution-related indoor air quality issues.
A second project that I read about was insulation. You started, I guess, by using hay bales.
A few years back, there was, quite a few years back, the straw has become a very popular idea of using as insulation. The Willamette Valley grows a lot of grass seed, so they have a lot of stalks left over. They used to get burned, and legislation happened a little while back to kind of limit that because of air pollution, but also I think there was even car accidents because of too much burning going on in the summertime. So it has become a really popular idea to why not use that in houses. I mean, more recently than not, just the idea of super insulating houses has come on. The idea is, which is, you know, basically make your house really well insulated and insulative, and then, you know, won't lose heat. So anyway, so APRO, about 5 years ago, got a grant, correct me if I'm wrong on this, from the USDA? Is that, or?
Oregon Department of
Oregon
Agriculture.
Oregon Department of Agriculture, sorry. And to build a straw bale house and have sensors throughout the walls to check for moisture content. Because the question that we had when it first came out was what's going to happen over time? We live in a very moist climate. Straw tends to wick up, you know, try to wick up water. So over time, is it not just going to become a big compost pile in your walls? So we decided we built this non-load bearing so that if it ever does rot, we can pull it out and put in a different kind of insulation. And we've been monitoring it over time to see how.
What are your preliminary findings?
Still too early to tell. The biggest danger areas would be, say, where there's a sink. And so we just took off some wall to do some work on the house in the sink area, and we're able to open it up. And after 5 years, it still looked pretty good. Uh-huh. Where we hadn't packed the straw nice and tight, there was definitely a little bit of mold, but that was probably more because of we didn't pack the straw in tight enough there. And that was one of the most dangerous areas. And after 5 years, it looks still pretty good. But still, 5 years in the lifespan of a house that's built for a millennia.
Yeah.
You know,
how thick is the hay bale? You know, is it
18 inches?
It's on its side, so 18 inches.
Uh-huh. Yeah. And what's the R value? Any idea?
R value is an interesting question because there have been two studies on R value of straw. People in the beginning were going around saying that straw had an amazing R value and you'd get an R60 wall or something. But now, usually a wall is somewhat moist, especially during our winters where it rains all the time. And so a normal straw wall is probably something like R2 per inch of thickness, which is still great. That's R36 for our walls. The wetter it gets, the less insulative value it has. And also, Mike was saying, you need to really pack the straw very tightly. The problem with a lot of straw walls is that where four bales come together, you can stick your arm right through it in the cross, you know, and that's going to lower your R value significantly. When Sandia did a test of a straw wall, it came out to R17. Because of all the holes between the bales. Mm-hmm. So that's something that people need to be aware of.
How about mold and those kind of dangers of mold? And
well, I guess the one thing that we found out that it was really important to have a heat source inside of the straw bale house, because when the air is warmer, it won't wet out. So if you have cold air and moisture, it'll actually go into moisture as opposed to humidity. I mean, it's a complicated process, but so, like, let's say if you built a straw bale shed or something like that with no heat source inside of it, it would rot out really quickly. So it's important to have heat inside. So if you have a heat source, less likely to have mold. I guess that would be one answer. But also, yeah, I mean, I don't think we don't really have a mold problem.
I think if you were gonna be very conservative, if my mother were to ask me, should I build a straw bale house? Then I would tell her, I think where the science of it all is now is if your relative humidity averages 70% or less for sustained periods of time, I think it's perfectly fine. That I don't think anyone looking at all of the data available would say that that's a problem. If it's above 70% in your area, especially if it's warm, people know that straw rots in those conditions because there's been many, many studies of farmers want to store straw. And so they've studied this a lot, and that's where the problems come in. Straw will rot in barns when it's completely dry just from gaining humidity from the air. Mm-hmm. And so you might want to look at some other technique if you're worried about the possibility of rot, if your relative humidity is above 70%.
But I'd also say that as far as in the form of a house, this is a relatively new thing in this climate. So 5 years for me is too early to tell.
Of course.
We're just in the beginning of this experiment.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Was there one other?
Oh, I think there's 100
lots of
things.
Mm-hmm.
There's solar. Well, we've studied lots of solar desalinization is a big topic, trying to turn salt water into fresh water using the sun. And there's lots of really interesting things that we could talk about. That solar drying is something that people need to be able to do. There's the whole question of how, in reality, do solar houses work? And I think that a lot of of the early architects may have had an incomplete understanding of thermodynamics of solar houses. So we study all those things. And that's just the beginning of how to dig a well on your own, that sort of thing.
We're getting pretty close to the end of our interview here. Why don't you fellows introduce yourself again? Let me just, for people who have just tuned in, we're in Cottage Grove, Oregon, and on a road trip, and we're interviewing a group of people involved in a very exciting, interesting environmental project.
But we're outside of Cottage Grove, Oregon.
But it's about half an hour, less than 45 minutes to get between Eugene and Cottage Grove. And anyway, what's the name of the facility and what you
got? Provecho Research Center is the name of the facility. It's a 40-acre land trust that focuses on sustainable agriculture, sustainable forestry, and appropriate technologies.
Yeah. And if you wanted to find you on the internet, how would you do that?
It's www.efn.org/APRO.
Okay.
Not all that simple.
Yeah.
Look up Aprovecho. It might be easier.
Yeah.
You can also just email us, too, and then we can send you the website.
So our email is APRO@EFN.org.
Okay, and I couldn't remember the name of it when I get out here, so what I did was look up rocket stoves, and by finding rocket stoves, I found... I put rocket stoves Oregon, and then found your facility.
Great.
So, because we want people to be able to find it, because, as you said, there are internships out here, and, you know, people...
10-week internship, 3 times a year, the classes are 9 to 5 every day. It's a really... in-depth, intensive introduction to the things that we've been talking about.
And once again, just say our email is APRO@EFN.org.
Okay.
There's one other thing that I'd just like to point out that I think is interesting about this whole little community and this whole what Aprovecho is that we're very downwardly mobile. The people here live on, the staff who live here make $400 a month. It's very, so people might think, oh my God, how can they even survive? But we're some of the richest people in the world. Like, I feel like our lifestyle here is incredibly wealthy. And so I'm sure there's a lot of people all throughout the states that think you need to earn $60,000, $100,000 a year. And the reality is we have all this time to be with friends and community and love. And it's very, in some ways it's sort of, it maybe was the original 60s dream, but without maybe... a lot of the negative aspects of it. We live very simple, wealthy lives, and it's possible to do in America.
Yeah, a lot of the people making 60 and 80 grand are finding out that that 60 or 80 grand doesn't exist anymore. I've run into quite a few of them these days, and maybe they're having second thoughts about their lifestyle.
And we're also very integrated into society as a whole too. So that's another different, the whole 60s dream about just dropping out is just not at all what we're also involved in. Mm-hmm. We're very much being part of a positive future.
And then I think maybe the other thing is, at least for me, and I'm 50 and was a hippie in the 60s, it's tough to live on your own and to try to be idealistic. It's really nice to live in a community of people where it's natural to think ecological thoughts and to think that your psychological well-being is important, that sort of thing. And it's living without that support. I've seen a lot of my friends have pretty difficult time staying idealistic, and so I think that's another important part of this.